Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Sam Pizzigatti, veteran labor journalist and author, who assesses the decline of the American middle class, rising income inequality, and public policy initiatives that can help reverse falling living standards. Lad Everett of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, who talks about Georgia's new gun law and the link between weak firearms regulations and increased gun violence. And Jerry Marie Leesgang of the Connecticut Trans Advocacy Coalition, who reflects on the wider significance of the case of a transgender teenager now being held in solitary confinement in a Connecticut prison. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
It's been over 2 years since U.S. combat troops left Iraq, and Iraqi voters went to the polls to elect a new parliament on April 30th amidst growing sectarian violence. Al-Qaeda-linked militants now control large sections of western Iraq, including the city of Fallujah, and there are growing fears Iraq may be on the verge of breaking apart. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, the nation's strongman Shiite leader, is expected to be re-elected with support from the Iraqi army, the Obama White House, and the Iranian government. According to the New Yorker magazine, Maliki's hyper-partisan Shiite regime shows little respect for the country's minority Sunni population. Saad Eskander, director of the National Archives in Baghdad, told the Christian Science Monitor, "The forces of disintegration are much more powerful than those of unity." Despite the deepening violence that has killed over 2,700 people so far this year, government wages are increasing and prosperity is starting to bubble up in the southern city of Basra, where oil exports are at their highest level in 30 years. But the World Bank's Marie-Hélène Bricknell urges caution, noting, "There's an urban elite doing quite well, but because of the displacement that is continuing to occur in this country, many people have lost everything." The streets of Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, exploded into violence after the death of a popular male dancer in a poor neighborhood. The favela had previously been cleared of drug gangs by the police in advance of the World Cup matches that will kick off in mid-June. After the discovery of the dancer's body next to a child care center, local residents attacked a nearby police station and set cars ablaze. According to the BBC, the dancer, Douglas Rafael da Silva Pereira, fled a shootout between the police and drug gangs, but later was caught by police. His family says he was beaten and tortured, but police state the dancer was killed by gunfire. In recent weeks, there have been repeated confrontations between police and residents of low-income communities in Rio. Last year, over 1 million people protested the government's lavish spending on the World Cup and demanded that the billions of dollars instead go to education and health care. Before the World Cup gets underway, Brazil's left-leaning Workers' Party government is pushing to institute new powers, including sentencing those who are convicted of inciting terror or threatening the life or health of another person to 15 to 30 years in prison. The government is anticipating large protests during the month-long World Cup, which will draw millions of fans from across the globe. The wave of Tea Party electoral victories in 2010 included 8 new right-wing governors who launched policy debates over union rights, tax cuts for the rich, and harsh reductions in spending for social services. Many also blocked the Affordable Care Act's expansion of Medicaid coverage for the working poor. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker soon became the lightning rod for the new Tea Party officials who declared war on collective bargaining for state workers. Tens of thousands of pro-union protesters responded by swarming the state capitol in Madison. Yet Walker prevailed and survived a recall vote. Now he's setting his sights on a presidential run in 2016. Other new Republican governors, like John Kasich of Ohio, Rick Snyder in Michigan, and Pennsylvania's Tom Corbett, have followed the same playbook developed by the Koch brothers-funded American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. Their legislative initiatives focused on weakening public employees' unions, government spending cuts, and slashing tax rates for the rich. These governors also imposed strict voter ID laws, resulting in the disenfranchisement of minority and low-income voters. However, despite bold promises to create new jobs, these Tea Party governors have a weak record in producing employment opportunities for state residents. According to an opinion poll conducted by Hart Research, these incumbents may now be vulnerable in the 2014 elections. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Since the birth of the Occupy Wall Street movement in New York City's Zuccotti Park in September 2011, America has seen more discussion and debate about rising income inequality. While many politicians, including President Obama, talk about the need to address inequality, little of substance has been done to reverse policies that exacerbate the accelerating wealth gap. Now a new study published in the New York Times, titled "The American Middle Class is No Longer the World's Richest," cites statistics from the Luxembourg Income Study database and concludes that the middle class in other industrialized nations around the world have seen considerably larger increases in income over the last three decades than their American counterparts. The study also found that poor Americans have fared even worse than the middle class in comparison to families with similar incomes living in Canada and Europe. Major factors in the different outcomes revolve around tax policies that favor the rich, lagging education attainment, the distribution of wealth upwards to the wealthiest sector, and the weakening of labor unions. Recent research on inequality and views on America's dysfunctional political system have found a large audience among Americans looking for answers about declining living standards. French economist Thomas Piketty's best-selling new book, Capital in the 21st Century, argues that unfettered capitalism inevitably leads to extreme income inequality. A new study by professors at Princeton and Northwestern University conclude that America is no longer a democracy, but an oligarchy where the rich call the shots. Your reporter spoke with Sam Pizzigatti, a veteran labor journalist and an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Here he assesses the decline of the American middle class, rising income inequality, and public policy initiatives that can help reverse falling living standards.
When you look at disposable income around the world, around the developed world, you see that it's been an incredibly lousy century so far for average Americans. Since the year 2000, disposable income in the United States has barely nudged it all. It's only up 0.3%. In other countries, by comparison, the increase is much, much higher. So you look at Spain. Spain we now see as a basket case with all sorts of economic trouble. But yet in Spain, they've had a disposable income increase of 4.1%, well over 10 times the U.S. increase. In Italy, another country that's doing very poorly economically, the increase has been 8%. In the Netherlands, 14%. In Canada, our neighbors to the north, they've seen a 20% increase in disposable household income since the year 2000. Again, we've seen 0.3%. So looking across the world, the developed world, our peer nations, the average people in the United States are really doing much, much worse than people elsewhere.
You know, there are a lot of people out there that probably don't understand the forces that contribute to inequality in this country. But by looking at the public policies of these other industrialized nations around the world and what they do different from the United States that contributes to less inequality than we have here, what can we learn?
I think the best comparison to make is the comparison within the United States. That is, the comparison between the United States today and where we were in the middle of the 20th century when we became the first nation in the world to create a mass middle class. And at that time, that mass middle class was built on two main factors. One, we had a strong labor movement in the United States. Over one out of every three workers carried a union card, and because of that, unions set the labor market pace, and even non-union workers ended up getting union-level wages because unions were so prevalent. Right now, less than 7% of U.S. workers hold union cards. Over vast swatches of the country, the labor movement and collective bargaining have essentially disappeared. So what we have is that the treasure that the United States economy is generating every year is flowing into the pockets of people at the top and not average Americans. And that's a prime source of the inequality that we're facing. Back in the middle of the 20th century, we also had a strong progressive tax system that limited inequities from the operations of the market. Income over $400,000 in the 1950s faced a 91% top tax rate. Now it's 39.6%. For that same income. So just by letting our progressive tax system atrophy, just by tolerating the assault on unions that we've seen over the past 50 and 60 years, we've changed the dynamics of income and wealth distribution in the United States. And other countries have not gone through that process to anywhere near the extent that we have here in the United States.
Sam, I also wanted to ask you, I guess the million-dollar question here, the trillion-dollar question, what are some of the policy prescriptions that you would advise the country take a serious look at, debate, and vote on in terms of the capacity to reverse economic disparity in this country? What are the ones that you think are the most important?
Well, there are a number of things, but I would say that the very first thing we need to do is we need to stop subsidizing inequality with our tax dollars, and that's exactly what we're doing right now. Every major corporation in the United States depends on government contracts and government tax subsidies of various support, whether you're talking about Lockheed Martin, the defense contractor, or General Motors, or Apple Computers. Every major corporation has its hand in the till in one way or another. So one thing that we're talking about, the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, is that we should tie government procurement and government tax breaks to corporate pay policies. And if a corporation is paying its top executives hundreds of times more than its average workers are receiving, that corporation should not be able to receive a government contract. That corporation should not be able to receive a government tax break. There are other things that we can do along that line. In California right now, the state of California, there's legislation pending that would tax corporations that have a high ratio between CEO and worker pay at a higher level than corporations that have a modest differential between CEO and worker pay. These are the sorts of steps I think we need to start thinking about. At the same time, we need to do the things that we know work from the past. We need to enable unions to organize and change the labor rules that benefit management so overwhelmingly today. And of course, we need to reinstitute a strong progressive tax system where people of great wealth pay a higher share of their income in taxes than people of modest means.
That was Sam Pizzagatti, an associate fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies and author of the book, The Rich Don't Always Win. Find links to Pizzagatti's online column, Too Much, and more analysis of economic inequality in the U.S. by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Since the horrifying December 2012 Newtown massacre, where deranged gunman 20-year-old Adam Lanza shot and killed 20 first graders and 6 educators at Sandy Hook Elementary School, states including Connecticut, California, Colorado, New York, and New Jersey have moved to strengthen laws governing gun sales. However, more than 24 states have moved in the other direction, passing laws that weaken gun control regulations, expanding in many cases the locations where concealed weapons are permitted to be carried. Most recently, Georgia's Governor Nathan Deal signed the Safe Carry Protection Act, which allows concealed carry permit holders to bring firearms into bars, schools, churches, and specific government buildings under certain circumstances. The law also expands the state's Stand Your Ground gun law and no longer requires firearms dealers to maintain records of sales and purchases for state purposes. While the National Rifle Association applauded Georgia's new law as the most comprehensive pro-gun bill in state history, Americans for Responsible Solutions, the gun control group founded by former Arizona Congresswoman Gabby Giffords, who was severely wounded in a 2011 mass shooting incident, called it the most extreme gun bill in America. Your reporter spoke with Vlad Everett, director of communications with the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Here he talks about Georgia's new gun law and the link between weak firearms regulations and increased gun violence.
The goal, as with every single other piece of legislation promoted by the NRA, is to sell more guns. Legislation like this is promoted to make people more comfortable with the notion of bringing guns out into public in virtually all places that they might go, and therefore in making people more comfortable or more likely to buy compact pistols, the types of weapons that you would use to carry. You know, some of the worst provisions of the bill deal with arming criminals. The most disgusting provision of the bill, I think, is the one that extends stand-your-ground protections to criminals illegally carrying guns in public, including felons, which is just unfathomable. There's another provision in that bill that allows first-time offenders, including people who are violent misdemeanants and some felons, to obtain concealed carry permits in Georgia. And there's another head-scratching provision that literally prevents law enforcement from stopping someone in public to make sure they are properly permitted to carry a gun in public. So if you are a criminal and you would like to bring a loaded gun out in public now in Georgia, you got a free pass because you can be totally confident that law enforcement cannot stop you and ask to see your permit. It's a grotesque bill, and it has nothing to do with safety and everything to do with putting more money in the pockets of rich NRA executives like Wayne LaPierre and Chris Cox.
How controversial was this in Georgia? You know, I haven't followed the local papers and local media outlets about what the debate was like, but it seems to me this would be highly controversial and polarizing, even in a southern state, you know, that is famously supportive of so-called Second Amendment rights. But what was the debate there like?
Well, it was incredibly controversial. I mean, I think it's important to understand, too, that the bill was originally far worse. The original version of the bill would have forced public colleges in Georgia to allow guns on their campus. Gun violence prevention activists in the state rallied and fought very hard alongside university administrators and students to defeat that provision. The original version of the bill also would have forced churches to allow guns on their premises. Faith leaders organized to defeat that. They now have the ability to opt out of that. And from what I understand, I am not aware of any church yet, although I suspect there will be some, that is elected to have guns on their premises yet. So this was a very hard-fought campaign. The bill was not approved literally, and this is no exaggeration, until like the last minute of midnight before the legislative session ended. I mean, it went right down to the wire. It was also very interesting because, you know, Georgia is not traditionally a state where gun violence prevention activists have a lot of strength, but we had a lot of people working this in Georgia this time, and we built a really nice coalition there that I think we can go back to in the future. So, the dynamic there looked a lot different this time. It was very, very controversial. It's a really dangerous situation.
Lad, what's the experience of other states who have these very open-ended gun laws? Has it contributed to a spike in violence in other places where these laws have gone into effect?
Well, absolutely. I mean, if you look, at the states in this country with the highest rates of gun death, it's like a who's who of states that have extremely weak gun laws. So, you know, just to name the top five states with the highest rates of gun death are Alaska, Louisiana, Montana, Alabama, and Wyoming. That's basically what it looks like. Weak gun laws lead to a higher rate of gun death. It's really not rocket science. Conversely, if you want to talk about the five states in this country with the lowest rates of gun death, from lowest moving up, Hawaii, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, New Jersey, and New York. So again, you know, this is not something that's rocket science. You know, when you take steps to properly secure firearms within the home and to deny firearms to people who are, you know, clearly dangerous or who have histories of violence, you save lives. It's that easy. You know, and we need to be moving in a direction in this country where more states are taking even basic steps to deny firearms to dangerous individuals and keep them away from kids.
That was Ladd Everett, Director of Communications with the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Learn more about groups advocating stricter gun regulations by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. A 16-year-old transgender girl, that is a person who was born biologically male but identifies as female, has been held in solitary confinement at York Correctional Institution, the Connecticut State Women's Prison, since April 8th. The girl, known as Jane Doe, remains in prison, although no criminal charges have been brought against her, much less has she been convicted of any crime. The decision to place Jane Doe in an adult prison, after first considering and then rejecting a youth prison for males and a new juvenile facility for girls, came from Joette Katz, the commissioner of the Department of Children and Families. Commissioner Katz said the girl is violent and there is no more appropriate and available setting for her at this time. Last week, the Hartford Courant newspaper published an op-ed piece written by Jane Doe in which she alludes to past traumas as she describes the trauma of her current imprisonment. On April 25th, about 50 supporters of Jane Doe held a rally outside the Department of Children and Families office in Hartford. At the same time, another support rally was also organized in New York City. At the Hartford rally, Jerry Marie Liesgang, the founder of the Connecticut Trans Advocacy Coalition, read Jane Doe's op-ed piece aloud, then commented about how the non-trans community can best support individuals like Jane Doe and others who identify as transgender, whether they are in prison or living in society at large.
This is an op-ed to the Hartford Courant by Jane Doe. A lot of things have been said about me recently. Some were said at court, and others were said in the news and by Department of Children and Families Commissioner Joette Katz. People might think they know me based upon what they hear, but they know nothing about who I am. I have been involved with DCF since I was a little kid. There were lots of problems in my family, and DCF got involved to help me. Over the years, I've had many DCF workers. Some really tried to help me. Others did it for the paycheck. I admit that I have acted out and got into fights. Many DCF kids fight with staff and other kids. I am not saying it was okay, but I have a lot of stuff built up inside me and don't know how to deal with it at times. They tell me that trauma changes people and makes them act out. Believe me, it does. Although my life has been harder than most anyone can imagine, the last few months were the worst. I haven't agreed with everything DCF has done, but I thought they were supposed to be on my side. That changed after what happened in Massachusetts. Forget what DCF said. I didn't blind anyone or break their jaw. DCF said a lot of things to make me look like a monster. Just think about how you would look if your worst enemy wrote down every bad thing you ever did, and on top of that, made things up. I sat in court for 6 days freaking out that I was going to a men's prison. The only person from DCF who was against me in court was a superintendent of Connecticut Juvenile Training School. He said I was the most dangerous person who had ever been at the school, he had never met me before, and he asked that I go to Manson Youth Institute. While I was at the school, I was perfectly behaved. He said that didn't matter. Commissioner Katz wouldn't come to court to explain why she said untrue things about me. She showed up on the last day and wouldn't even look at me. The other people from DCF who came to court said really nice things about me. They asked to work on my business unit because they liked being with me. One training school worker visited me when she wasn't working. I really miss her. Now, I am sitting in a room at the end of a hallway in the psych ward at York Correctional Institution. I'm in my room 22 hours a day with a guard staring at me, even when I shower and go to the bathroom. It's humiliating. Women constantly scream and cry, and it was hard to sleep. They moved me down to a different hallway where it's not as crazy. I tell myself that this is just a nightmare, but it doesn't end. I know that I need to work on my issues, and I want to, but this is not the place. I am afraid of the women here. I don't want to be around them. They yell comments to me and make fun of me when they see me. People tell me that a lot of the news stories focus on DCF. I don't want this to be about them. I don't care about people who don't care about me. DCF is wrong for what they have done to me, but making them look bad isn't going to help me. I want people to understand who I am, what my life has been like, and how I ended up here. What I have survived would have destroyed most people. I'm not going to let it destroy me. I can't change what has happened, but I can build a future just like every other 16-year-old. If Commissioner Katch wants to know who I am, she should come to this prison and meet me. If she does, she will see that I am more than what is written on paper. I am a girl with a lot going on in her life. We all make mistakes, but I don't deserve this. As a footnote, Jane Doe is a pseudonym for a 16-year-old who was considered a male at birth but identifies as female. She is in custody of the state, and her name is withheld because of her age. We've done a lot of advocacy for trans women, especially within the Hartford area, and trans folks. But what you see here is not different. People need to sort of step in the shoes of the trans people. And we have a lot of, even the allies, that we appreciate it, but you really have to understand what it's like. And this is a girl who's been through the system, and we've had other folks. And what happens is you're basically struggling and fighting every single day of your life just to be who you are. It's like myself, any of us, we're forever being hassled. And so you can just imagine this poor girl coming through a system as a gender identity, transitioning very young and trying to survive through all these foster care houses of people who most likely don't care about her. And so she really has been victimized her whole life. And the key thing is for the system to recognize, as she said, the PTSD, the trauma that she's going through. And we don't answer that or correct that by putting somebody into the prison system. And we run into this so much with trans folks, it's a shame. And it's usually folks of color. We had one woman who, she was basically being put on the street by a pimp. She finally fought back to a pimp, beat him up, and then she got put into prison. She got put into the males population of prison. And we finally advocated for it, and when she was coming, this was many years ago, when she was coming out, we made the case that it's a case of domestic violence. If she comes back out of prison, there's no one there to advocate for. She was living in a homeless shelter, and she's going to be put back out in the street with no way to defend herself. And if she does defend herself, they're going to put her into prison. And what we did is we ended up getting her into a domestic violence shelter. And she was actually one of the first trans folks to get in a domestic violence, woman's domestic violence shelter here in Connecticut. And it worked out. There weren't any issues. People were worrying that there'd be issues. And the key thing is that's what you do. When you put women together who are dealing with trauma in a woman's shelter and things like that, that's your job as an advocate, is to work through that. And she actually worked out very well. She finally moved to California and really got back on her life. And this is the same thing that needs to be done with Joanne. And that's why Trans Advocacy was there. But it's more than an organization. It's the people. And we really need to. And an organization as big as DCF can't get that personal. And that's unfortunate.
That was Jerry Marie Liesgang, founder of the Connecticut Trans Advocacy Coalition. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. Find more news and commentary on Jane Doe's imprisonment by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.